This show is going out to all of you listening in truck stops and greasy spoons and all over North America. A shout out to all of you Nighthawks at the diner. I like my eggs sunny side up at midnight, and I wear sunglasses when I eat them because they're so bright. They're almost as blinding as my love for you, only not as runny. That's a Jared Kintz, one of my favorite authors, who wrote, "This book is not for sale, in this program is not for sale." Well, hi there. Richard Serrett filling in for George Norrie here on Coast to Coast, Toronto's AM affiliate, Talk Radio AM 640. That's right, AM. Amplitude modulation. Ask your parents about that, for those of you born after 1975. And it is indeed a thrill and an honor, a privilege to be with you tonight, this morning. Thanks for inviting me into your home, your camper, your long-haul truck, your cabin in the woods. Just to note, George Norrie and Tom Danheiser have landed in Toronto. George will be taking the stage at the Queen Elizabeth Theatre, just a few minutes' drive west from where I'm perched. And George will be welcoming Alex Jones and Nick Pope. There's going to be a lot of people there, I tell you. It's going to be like a rock concert for the conspiracy and paranormal minded. You know, there was a time when people who were interested in conspiracies and the paranormal, you could gather them in the basement of a local library. But now, something's changing. There's a sea change, and I think you can sense it. People are waking up. People are flocking to these events. And pretty soon, George's events will be as big as Woodstock. What we had in mind was breakfast in bed for 500,000. It's like wavy gravy on the grassy knoll. All right, okay, I'm dating myself. Anyway, it's a Friday night and into Saturday morning, and that means, you well know, the last 2 hours of this juggernaut are set aside for open lines. Here's how it works. You pick up the telephone, you call in, and you steer this wonderful jazz conversation anywhere you want to take it. Now, that's quite a responsibility. It's the First Amendment meets the audio imaginarium, brought to you by Reginald Fezzanin, a Canadian, I might add, the true inventor of radio. I had to say that. Reginald Fezzanin, this is true, Reginald Fezzanin was transmitting spoken words and music ship to shore when Marconi was still sending Morse code. Look it up. In the first 2 hours, we are going to have some fun. Oh, we are going to have some fun. We're going to dive into the shadows of American history, where the truth often is to be found. Donald Jeffries has penned an impressive, controversial tome, an expose of modern crimes, conspiracies, and cover-ups. It's called Hidden History, and he's standing by and ready and willing to get down and dirty. He knows where the bodies are buried, and he's going to rattle some cages. Hope you'll be along for the ride. My name is Richard Serrett, and you are listening to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast AM. Richard Serrett sitting in for the indefatigable George Norrie, the hardest working man in show business, who, as I speak, is in town, Toronto, Canada, along with his trusty producer, Tom Danheiser, getting ready to hit the stage in about, what, 13 hours, 14 hours at the Queen Elizabeth Theatre at the Canadian National Exhibition here in Toronto. And I will be there, and I am looking forward to seeing George and Tom again. All right, Donald Jeffries has been researching the JFK assassination since the mid-1970s, when he was a teenager volunteer for Mark Lane's Citizens Committee of Inquiry. He's very active on all the JFK assassination forums, and he's been a moderator on the London Spartacus Education Forum for several years. His first published book, the acclaimed 2007 novel, The Unreals, has been compared to Alice in Wonderland and The Wizard of Oz. Hidden History is his first nonfiction book. Donald Jeffries, welcome to Coast. How are you?
Fine, thanks. Thanks for having me.
A pleasure. Let's be frank, to a lot of people listening, JFK is ancient history. So how do you explain the importance of the murder in plain sight of the 35th president to young people who, let's be frank, when you ask young people today, where were you when JFK was shot, they think you're talking about the Oliver Stone movie.
Exactly. Well, I think that more and more young people are just becoming enamored of conspiracies in general because they look at what's going on in the world and they realize that when they do turn on the television news, which is not that often for young people, I don't believe, that they're not being told the truth. And I believe the JFK assassination is so important because it was really the first big television event as far as a political event. It was covered, saturation coverage. We get nonstop coverage of the funeral and first live murder on television when Oswald was shot by Ruby. And for people like me, I was 7 years old at the time. It had a huge impact on me. I think there are lots of people like that, especially people that were older. They were teenagers at the time or young people that were in the Peace Corps or just getting ready to go in the Peace Corps that had been inspired by Kennedy. So I think that what happened is that even though they may not have realized anything in terms of conspiracy at that time, once we were given this really lame, inadequate explanation that this two-bit mobster had shot Oswald and that was it, let's forget about it and not talk about it anymore. I think that just, I believe, paved the way for the rest of the 60s. Whether it was verbalized or not by a lot of people, I think that's really what set the tone. And that's why I think it's so important today, is because even though, as I write in my book, conspiracy certainly happened way before 1963, but the Kennedy assassination was really the first one of our generation, which I think set off, set the tone for the next 50 years. And I think, really, like the beginning of a math equation, I think that's why we are at the point we're at searching for answers, because the beginning of the equation was there's huge errors there. So I think it's very important to still study it.
You just said something I think that's very profound and important. It's almost, this equation that's leading us someplace. And are the chickens coming home to roost now? I mean, do you see... not to get overly political here or partisan here, but do you see anything in the incredible, almost hysteria now over people like Donald Trump? Do you see any correlation between what happened in the 60s, the assassinations of John F. Kennedy, Robert F. Kennedy, Martin Luther King? Do you see any correlation between what happened then to what's happening now? This hysteria over Trump, this rejection of the status quo and the establishment and the party bosses.
Yeah, I think that Trump, especially the phenomenon that is Trump, I think is simply the fact that even though it certainly seems he's an ultimate insider, but I think the public is just so dissatisfied with politics as usual, and they're so tired of political correctness. And all Trump has done is he's throw out some of these sound bites where he's just saying something that sounds refreshing because you're not used to politicians saying that, and he's giving the people a little meat. He's throwing a little populism their way. I mean, I can't imagine what my all-time political hero is Huey Long. I can't imagine what a Huey Long would do in today's world because he would have so much to talk about. And he certainly was brilliant the way he talked about things. But Trump is throwing a little bit of meat out there to the public, and I think they're aching for something like that, and they're just typically not given any choices. I mean, if it comes down to another Bush versus another Clinton, a certain percentage of them will go vote along party lines. But the great majority of people, I think, are out there apathetic, and they're searching for something. And it may not be exactly like the 1960s, but I believe, as a lot of people do, I believe we're on the verge of collapse. I don't think the economy can continue the way it is, and I think we're not going to see assassinations this time. I really think we're going to see a complete economic collapse, and I don't want that to happen, but I don't see any way for this economy to continue when you have, so much wealth concentrated in the hands of so few, and when you have a real unemployment rate. I mean, they're telling people that 94 million to 100 million Americans of adult age are out of work, and in the next breath they'll tell you the unemployment rate is 5 or 6%. You do the math. I mean, we have an unemployment rate in reality that rivals anything seen during the Great Depression. So And we don't have a World War II looming on the horizon that's going to get us out of the Great Depression. Is that? I don't think that'll work again. So, I wish I could be more optimistic about it, but you know, it's just that's what my book I think details: 50 years of just horrible decisions, tons of cover-ups, and corruption just rampant everywhere. The chickens are coming home to roost. You can't have that much corruption at every level of our society and expect to have an open, free democracy or republic or whatever you want to call it.
Are you shocked, surprised, dismayed that the culture, popular culture, is not reflective of the tumultuous times that we're living in? Where are the protest songs? Where are the protests? Quite frankly. Yeah.
Well, you're right. There is, but I think it may not be the same kind of protest, but I think you see it in the media. I was watching some of these. I watch some of these science fiction shows that are on now. There's so many of them that have the same kind of theme. There's apocalyptic dystopian themes in so many television shows and movies now, where something big's going to happen, all the power goes out, the aliens land, everything collapses. This is a recurring theme in, coming out of Hollywood, and I think even they recognize it on some level. Maybe they just think that sells. But I think that we, you know, unfortunately, we don't have perhaps the same type of thinkers that maybe we had at that point. I mean, certainly Oliver Stone protested in whatever way he can, and Alex Jones, or you mentioned earlier, was George Norrie. He says all the time on his show that he has, you know, he doesn't name them all, but he has had celebrities on there. That apparently there are a lot of celebrities behind the scenes that, you know what's going on, and maybe they're just playing the game. They can't do the kind of music or movies or television shows maybe that they want to do, but they're playing the Hollywood game and putting out the same pabulum that we've seen for years. But behind the scenes, apparently, at least according to him, they're at least somewhat aware of what's really going on.
Donald Jeffries is with us, the author of Hidden History. Do you think, dialing it back to Kennedy, where we began the conversation, and all roads, it seems, when we're talking conspiracy, lead to the grassy knoll in Dallas, Texas. But do you think that Kennedy was the last executive or leader of the executive branch who really had control? I mean, has the office of the president been degraded so significantly since that time that really he's just a ribbon cutter, or she is just a ribbon cutter at this point?
Yeah, I think that Kennedy, looking at it as an armchair psychologist, Kennedy grew up in a very sheltered environment. As he said, I believe that he learned about the Great Depression only through the history books. Obviously, we know he came from a very wealthy family. I believe, you know, people like that come into an office like the presidency with probably grand visions. And I think Kennedy was an idealist. He was both a pragmatic person and an idealist. But I believe once he got in there, and he was shocked right at the beginning of his administration by the Bay of Pigs, and he felt betrayed. He had to take the blame. Unlike a lot of our leaders today, he came right out and said, I'm the responsible officer. I take full blame. But behind the scenes, he fired Alan Dulles. He fired the top three people in the CIA, and we know Alan Dulles later was one of those investigating his assassination, so certainly there was no love lost there. But, I believe he was trying to do a lot of things. I mean, he was talking about abolishing the CIA at that point, scattering it to the winds, and certainly no president had ever done that before and certainly would ever do it again. And I believe, along with his brother, he really trusted no one outside of Robert Kennedy, and he was probably the second most powerful man in the country at that time, although some people may have thought he was more powerful than John Kennedy. But, I think he was the last one. You might say Nixon attempted to do so, maybe to not necessarily use his power for good, but I believe Nixon may have tried to be a strong executive. But ever since that time, the executive decisions, when an executive seems to flex his muscles, it's always in the same way. They're probably doing it at the behest of forces behind the scenes, but it's always to declare war on some small country and act tough, or to demand sacrifice again and again from the great mass of the people who simply can't sacrifice anymore, to bail out the banks, that kind of stuff. That's when they try to show that they're powerful. But you never hear anybody do it. Like Kennedy, you know, making the speech he did about U.S. Steel and that kind of thing. You know, things you just don't hear executives. The speech he gave at American University about peace. I mean, that's just mind-boggling to listen to that now, to imagine any American politician doing that today. So, and again, I think that's a bit of the attraction of Trump, is that Trump, the Americans are so tired of these weak leaders who just have no courage, who don't act strong. And I think that's why Putin, you know, when Trump has talked about his admiration for Putin, that Putin acts like an old-fashioned man. He acts tough, but he doesn't, and he's a very strong nationalist. And I think Trump is trying to do something like that. When he comes on, he's, you know, saying, like, it's the Black Lives Matters when they're protesters are there. If they come on stage with me, you know, they'll have another. I mean, it's probably all blowing smoke, but I think there's a lot of people out there that want to see something like that. But, you know, I wish they would talk tough about the right issues, but I think Kennedy, though, to answer your question, ultimately, I think he was the last executive, really, that tried to do things on his own and circumvent the powers that be. He was certainly the last president, and he rejected overtures toward war over and over again during the missile crisis, and certainly during Vietnam with his National Security Action Memorandum 263, which completely overturned our policy there and paved the way for a complete withdrawal by 1965.
What happens to a president when he goes off script? I mean, we have these leaders, these political mavericks, and they talk about change you can believe in the case of Obama. But what happens to them, do you suspect, Donald, when they become occupants of the White House? Does someone from the national security state sit down with them and have a candid conversation and say, now here's the way it's really going to happen? What happens to that candidate who is so full of progressive ideas and so full of promise and hope that captivates the American public, and then seems to do almost a complete 180 or an about face once they enter into the Oval Office?
Well, yeah, you know, that's who knows. I mean, they all come to some kind of secret meeting in robes or whatever. I don't know if it's anything that dramatic, but we can look at all the candidates. I mean, many presidents in recent memory, Jimmy Carter, for instance. When he was elected president in 1976, it was really the height of the anti-Warren Commission movement. I mean, the House Select Committee on Assassinations was about to be, which where I first got my start, working for Mark Lane's group, lobbying for that. Jimmy Carter's sister, people don't remember, Ruth Carter Stapleton, was very active in investigating the Kennedy assassination, and certainly he had to have known about that. To my knowledge, he never commented on the assassination, never talked about it. He talked about John Kennedy being his hero, but he didn't capitalize. And even as a politician, you think he would have tried to capitalize on that. He certainly could have impressed people like me, but he didn't. And later, Bill Clinton supposedly told Webb Hubble, his attorney general, assistant attorney general, that before he entered the White House, he wanted him to find out two things: who really killed JFK and the secrets about UFOs. Well, you know, Clinton, again, during he was president, he was elected right after the Oliver Stone, movie JFK really reignited the controversy over the assassination, and he never capitalized on it, and he was asked about it eventually, and just lamely said in public, yeah, he believed that Oswald did it. And behind the scenes, he supposedly didn't, and Al Gore, supposedly his vice president, was very active about saying that he believed there was a conspiracy. But to my knowledge, he never made a speech about it publicly. And you can even go back to Ronald Reagan. David Liston, who wrote Best Evidence, he verified for me in an email that a Reagan insider told him that he was obsessed with the JFK assassination. Maybe obsessed is too strong a word, but he kept books on his nightstand that he would read about the subject in the White House. So, and again, he never said anything about it during those days either. So I don't know if they're just, it was just kind of typical political cowardice or what, but I mean, there aren't any profiles in courage. Certainly, there haven't been any profiles in courage in the White House since JFK was assassinated.
Is there a trail, do you think, that leads from those that were involved in the Kennedy assassination through to RFK, MLK, maybe even Malcolm X, all the way through to 9/11?
Oh, I think, again, the names change. Certainly, you can't all be the same people, you know, killing Kennedy and then, you know, 9/11, you know, 40 years later, whatever. But what I think it happens is that, as I try to talk about in the book, it's a systematic way of doing business, that the people in power have been corrupt for a long time, and they perpetuate themselves.
All right, Donald, listen, I got to jump in. We'll take a timeout. Taking us into the break, American Chanteuse from the Stone Ponies, Linda Ronstadt, and Different Drum. Don Jeffries marches to a different drum. We'll be back with more of our conversation right here on Coast to Coast AM. Don't go away. Here's a cat who doesn't get his due. James Carr. What a set of pipes. The late James Carr pouring water on a drowning man. Richard Serrett sitting in for George Norrie, who is in town and will be hitting the stage in 13, 14 hours from now here in Toronto at the Queen Elizabeth Theatre, and I will be there. I can't wait. Got my ticket ready to go, and he'll be bringing Alex Jones and Nick Pope onto the stage. It's going to be quite a show, and I hope to see you down there here in Toronto again, the Queen Elizabeth Theatre. At the Canadian National Exhibition Grounds, which I think is the CNE, which is our big fair. We are, I believe, in our 137th or 138th year. All right. We will come back in just a few moments and continue our conversation with Donald Jeffries, author of Hidden History. Stay with us right here on Coast to Coast AM. Hidden History, an expose of modern crimes, conspiracies, and cover-ups in American politics. Donald Jeffries right here on Coast to Coast. Donald, I'm an interloper. I'm a Canadian. But I have long suspected that in the United States, there isn't really a Republican Party. There's not a Democratic Party. It's really a two-headed monster, a one-party system controlled by what some have called the equestrian class, the unelected oligarchs, and voters are essentially presented with a pre-approved slate of candidates. In other words, it's really an illusion. What are your thoughts on that?
Absolutely, absolutely. It's what, again, to quote Huey Long again, he called them Tweedledum and Tweedledee back in the 1930s, or High Papa Loam and Low Papa Hyam. I mean, they really are identical on all important issues. They agree. I mean, just the fact that for the last, I don't know when they first started talking about it, again, probably going back to Kennedy, Robert F. Kennedy was the last serious candidate that really had a chance to be, and I go into my book why I don't think Eugene McCarthy falls into that category, but Robert F. Kennedy was, when he was running in 1968, he was such a threat to them because he was carrying forward his brother's policies of, he wasn't buying this bipartisan foreign policy stuff. I mean, and they, you know, people, Americans have bought into that. They accept that when they started, the media kept referring to, we have to have a bipartisan foreign policy. That's just telling you there's no disagreement. And because we're seemingly always at war or preparing for war, that means there's no room for any kind of a peace candidate. So, and you know, they are, both parties agree to all these terrible trade deals, which is again one of the appeals of Donald Trump, as he has mentioned that. He hasn't gotten into specifics, but that's what made Ross Perot so appealing. You know, he was certainly right about NAFTA, and, you know, he was telling us that giant sucking sound. Well, that giant sucking sound has sucked all the industry out of America in the last 20-plus years, and both parties support that. We saw that with the Trans-Pacific Partnership, where both Republicans and Democrats fell all over themselves. You know, you see a few people like Elizabeth Warren that talked about it and opposed it, but it was inevitable that it was going to go through, and there is no disagreement on these things. I mean, we see with immigration, both, and again, that's Donald Trump's appeal there. I mean, these are common sense things. If a nation doesn't guard its borders, it's not a nation, and we haven't been guarding our borders since the 1980s, and that's an issue that has directly affects. I mean, we certainly don't need more potential workers in the country when we have a real unemployment rate of probably 25% or so, maybe more. And yet, immigration is one of those issues that both the left and the right agree on, because the left can't criticize it because of political correctness, and the right doesn't criticize it because they're desirous to have cheap labor. And that's where we are. We're caught. If there is a difference between the two parties, the left is just totally devoted to this authoritarian political correctness doctrine, where they seemingly want to throw everyone into prison for anything that offends them, and they're not concerned. They used to be concerned about getting people's rights. used to be concerned with trying to get everyone to have civil rights, everyone to have civil liberties. Now they want to take people's civil liberties and civil rights away. And the right, on the other hand, is just completely addicted to business being allowed to do whatever they want. I mean, they want to bring back child labor, half of them. They want to eliminate the minimum wage law, and they just want to concentrate the wealth again into fewer and fewer hands. So if there is a difference between them, it's that. But, I mean, it's to me, that's like choosing between electrocution and hanging. I mean, there's nothing good there. There's nobody talking about civil liberties. There's nobody talking about disengaging from all these foreign countries and letting everyone, let other countries decide their own fates and come home and solve America's problems first, build our roads, build our infrastructure up. I mean, we have so many problems here at home that we don't address because we're so busy spending this untold sums of money off in Iraq, Afghanistan, whatever. Now, there's a new country, Syria, Iran, whatever. They're always talking about going somewhere and meddling in someone else's country, and our country is falling apart. It's like feeding the neighbor's children when your own are starving.
There's an old saw, and I don't know, it could be entirely apocryphal. There could be a kernel of truth to it, and that is that back in 1992, the governor of a, in quotes I say this, a backwater state, that's not my term, that's, you know, Arkansas, the governor of Arkansas, before 1992, went to a Bilderberg meeting. His name was William Jefferson Clinton, a virtual unknown. And at the Bilderberg meeting, he met David Rockefeller. And again, the legend goes that Rockefeller gave Clinton a master's class in globalism. And when William Jefferson Clinton responded, "Yes, Mr. Rockefeller, anything you say, I'm on board with that," Rockefeller shook Clinton's hand and said, "Thank you very much. Congratulations, Mr. President." And it wasn't soon after that the MSM, the mainstream media, suddenly declared this virtual unknown as the front runner in the Democratic nomination process, and he became president. What do you think of that? I mean, is there any substance to that? Is that how it works? Is it possible to become president if you are not a globalist through and through?
I don't think so. No, at this point, no. And again, and that's one of the obviously the main difference, the main similarities between the Republicans and the Democrats is that they all are committed globalists. They all. I mean, how many times do you hear them say, "We live in a global economy, and we can't be." We can't withdraw from the world. We can't put up a wall. We can't be protectionist. In other words, you can't. They're telling you that as Americans, we can't have or expect our leaders to protect our own industries, to protect our own borders. I mean, it's nonsense, and it contradicts everything the Founding Fathers ever said. But we, you know, the last protectionist. I mean, Pat Buchanan was a protectionist when he ran for president. But Perot may have had a little of that in him. But all of the major candidates for Democrats and Republicans certainly are diehard globalists, and we hear this theme over and over again, and that's whether there was anything that dramatic with Bill Clinton, I don't know. I wouldn't doubt it, but you're exactly right with the mainstream media anointing him as the front runner. I mean, they did that in 1976 with Jimmy Carter, I believe also with David Rockefeller, they had just formed the Trilateral Commission, and it was the same kind of thing. And you can go all the way back to the 1932, I believe, where Herbert Hoover learned that he was not with the. No, I'm sorry. It was Calvin Coolidge learned that he was not going to be renominated or something at Bohemian Grove when he was there. And so these decisions are made, whether it's Bohemian Grove, the Bilderbergs, Council Foreign Relations meetings. Who knows where they're made? But the mainstream media certainly, when you hear them declare a front runner. And there's how do you define what a front runner is? But it's certainly never going to be like a Ron Paul. We saw what happened in his campaign in 2012 when he was being constantly downplayed, and they were trying to minimize his impact when he clearly had the biggest crowds. And yet they found this Rick Santorum guy who they you would see him at events where there was a handful of people. And Ron Paul, you know, I went to one event Ron Paul's in my area, and people were wrapped around the buildings three and four times over. Cars were running, were driving by, honking their horns constantly, people holding signs. He had the most support of anybody, and he finally got so fed up with it, he said, you know, that my people have determined that we had more people at one campaign rally in a particular district than they claim voted for us. And that happened over and over again, but the mainstream media will still tell you who the front runner is. Right now, Donald Trump appears to be that, but you're getting mixed signals there. Certainly, it doesn't look like they're coming out with a dark horse like they did with like a Michael Dukakis back in the day, Jimmy Carter, Bill Clinton, where people that kind of came back from the pile and they suddenly determined, was the front runner. But all the only reason they can even say this is because of all these polls, which serve no purpose at all. I mean, how can anybody be a front runner when a single vote hasn't been cast in the first primary? Yet that's what they do, and it's to try to minimize, like, you know, when Dennis Kucinich was running as a Democrat, they were afraid of him. So they had to minimize him when Ron Paul certainly, and now Rand Paul is probably the Republican they probably fear the most, because I don't think he's anywhere near what his father was. He's playing too much politics, but he's the only candidate in either party that is talking some kind of sense on foreign policy about staying out of people's affairs in other countries, and he's also the only one talking about civil liberties.
Donald Jeffries is the author of Hidden History, an expose of hidden crimes, conspiracies, and cover-ups in American politics, right here on Coast to Coast AM. Richard Serrett sitting in for George Norrie. Do you think this election cycle is different? Has the likes of Donald Trump finally wrested control of the process from the party bosses, from the equestrian classes, from the elites? I mean, is this finally an example of where we, the people, might succeed? Are you optimistic?
Well, I'd like to be, but Donald Trump is really a complex guy because, I mean, on the surface, I would be the last person that would be attracted to me. I mean, he has come out and said Edward Snowden should be assassinated, I believe. I mean, so certainly he's a typical neocon war hawk, or at least that's what he appears to be. But he said some really common sense things about immigration and certainly about trade and political correctness. But, you know, I think that where he's going, I don't know, because he seems to have, as I said, to be a typical establishment guy, but Jesse Ventura, for instance, is a very good friend of his. He was talking on the Alex Jones show recently how he'd be willing to be Donald Trump's vice presidential candidate. Roger Stone, a very, very good man, was running his campaign briefly. So, he seems to have people liking him and be connected to people that, I mean, he's connected to Jesse Ventura. I don't know how the subject of conspiracy couldn't come up at least at some point. So, I don't know. Maybe Donald Trump is a closet conspiracy guy. I really don't know. But I mean, it would be certainly at this point. It's wait and see as far as I'm concerned. But I wouldn't get too excited about it. But it is interesting. He said some interesting things, and we'll see. He's also the only one, by the way, that talked about the real unemployment rate being higher, and he's also talked about the danger of vaccines. So he's touching on subjects that are verboten. And if he starts talking about, you know, the Kennedy assassination or 9/11, certainly, and he's talked about Obama's birth certificate before too. So he's willing to go out there on the limb. It's just a question of whether he's the real deal or not. I think we'll have to see. But those of us who have been, you know, following politics for a long time, it's hard to believe that that anybody is going to be allowed to get that far. But he is, you know, he's a billionaire, so I don't know, maybe they can't ignore him. We'll see. I'm playing a wait-and-see game with it.
Well, I want to be very careful here and tread very lightly, because you mentioned, you know, we'll see how far he can get. And I certainly, you know, don't wish anything untowards to happen to Mr. Trump. But I mean, there are. We saw what happened to Richard Nixon when he went off script, and I think there was sort of a different methodology behind how you take someone down. We had, you know, a president taken out in plain sight in 1963, and then the methodology changed in the 1970s. A different type of assassination through Watergate, perhaps. But do you think that Trump could present such a threat to the established order? I mean, we are seeing, you know, he's made these accusations against Fox that there was a deliberate order from the top to take him out. Do you think there's any substance to that there is now a movement to take him out by any means necessary?
Well, certainly assassinations actual assassinations of political figures have kind of seemed to have gone out of style. The character assassination seems, as you mentioned, as it was done with Richard Nixon, certainly seems to be more in vogue, or has been in vogue for a long time. I think if we ever had any kind of even halfway knight in shining armor that rode to the rescue, it would probably have to be someone of Trump's ilk. It would have to be a billionaire. I think, you know, that's why when Ross Perot ran, I don't think anybody at this point, I don't think your average citizen could mount any kind of a campaign that really went against the status quo unless they had substantial financial means. And I think that, you know, it goes back to Kennedy in a way. I mean, Kennedy certainly had a great deal of money. So I think, you know, and of course, you know, we talk about how dangerous the 1% can be, and I don't certainly consider them an ally, but people need to remember, you know, the only reason we ever had a war for independence was because of some of the richest people in America decided they wanted it. You know, John Hancock signed his huge name to the Declaration of Independence, George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, the Adams. These were very wealthy people, and they really did risk their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honor. And it would take something like that now, but can we really imagine, you know, Bill Gates and Warren Buffett and these people? I mean, they're benefiting from the corrupt system, and they achieve their success because of the corrupt system. In Trump's case, I don't know. Maybe he's a renegade billionaire. I'd like to think, you know, that part of me, you know, the guy that still loves Frank Capra films and is waiting for the fairy tale, you know, Jerry Cooper, Jimmy Stewart guy to ride to the rescue. I'm hoping that that's the way it is. That Trump was just a businessman. It was using people and, you know, using the system, as he said, and playing the game. But behind the scenes was cavorting with the likes of Jesse Ventura. So maybe there's something there. But I think it would have to be someone of his financial wherewithal to be able to mount something. And I think that's probably why they're having a hard time figuring out what to do with Trump, because they, you know, they kind of made him into the star he was with the You're Fired and this, you know, The Apprentice and all that, and he became a celebrated figure. And maybe they had no idea that he had these views, you know, these private views behind the scenes. Assuming they're real, I mean, I'm hoping he's being legitimate here. And I think we saw the same kind of thing with Mel Gibson. You know, when he first got into trouble, you know, with his political incorrectness, where he was the sexiest man alive and the number one film star. So it was really hard for them. They really could. It's hard for them to the same media that builds these people up to suddenly tear them down. And I think that's why we kind of saw that with Charlie Sheen in the way when he started talking about 9/11 and everything on maybe a smaller level. But in Trump's case, he's a huge celebrity any way you look at it. And now he's running for president, and maybe he caught them off guard by saying these things. They didn't expect that. And but certainly the way they've reacted on the surface, the media, you know, the first debate with Fox News, I mean, it was just every question directed at him was like a personal, you know, a personal question or some kind of way that would look like they were attacking him, where everybody else was asked policy questions. So I don't know. We'll see what happens.
Yeah, I when you look at his policies, actually, they're not that extreme. Immigration, it's pretty mainstream. In when you look at the polls on how many Americans feel about things like immigration, you know, simplify the tax code. That's not, you know, that was right out of Reagan's playbook. He's not really that extreme. What I think, and you touched on this, has the establishment so, you know, they're in fits about is the fact that he is independently wealthy, doesn't require these super PACs, owes allegiance to no one. You know, there will be no lobbyists asking for favors. And so he is, you know, a free man on the land. He is, that's to me why he is so threatening to the established order. He can't be controlled. He can't be controlled.
That's for sure. Yeah, I mean, you're right. I mean, how do you buy somebody like Trump? And as you note, it's not that he's extreme. I mean, he's really voicing the concerns that still a majority of people have, certainly about immigration and trade. The average, I mean, you can go back to the banker bailout. You know, 90, 90-some percent of all Americans in every poll were against the banker bailout, but all our candidates, Republican and Democrat, that were running for president, the leaders of the House and the Senate, were all for it. And that's the kind of disconnect we see that shows exactly how out of touch our leaders are or how little they care, because if they really were riding the wave, a lot of times we get this stuff in the mainstream media that they're afraid to go against the grain and they're afraid to go against public sentiment. Well, that's hogwash. I mean, huge majorities have always believed that the JFK assassination was a conspiracy, going back to the 1960s in every poll. Yet every major political leader toes the line, and they certainly don't demand an investigation in that. I don't know what the figures are as far as 9/11, but I think a good percentage of the public, you know, realizes that we weren't told the truth about 9/11.
Absolutely. Listen, Don, got to jump in here. We'll take a timeout. Come back with Donald Jeffries, Hidden History, right here on Coast to Coast. Salt of the Earth, the Rolling Stones, taking us into the break. Stay a while.